Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Crystal Compass podcast. You're listening to episode 29 of our monthly show, and I'm Megan Marie, Senior Community Manager at Crystal Dynamics and your host. This episode, we're diving into the systems of survival in Rise of the Tomb Raider, speaking to Game Director Brian Horton from the studio. He'll also join us for the Take 5 Q&A segment. In our classic Crystal feature, which follows a nostalgic music break, we'll dive into a list of our favorite Easter eggs in the Tomb Raider franchise. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. All right, so we are going to talk about the systems of survival shortly with Brian Horton. But first, a bit of news. Our brand coordinator, Robin Huey, is joining me so that you're not going to tire of hearing my voice quite so quickly. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Megan. Hi, everyone.
Okay, our first story is rather a big news story of the month, Lara Croft Relic Run. Crystal Dynamics and Square Enix have been working with a talented team at Simutronics who are developing Relic Run. Relic Run is an adventure runner that offers a pretty impressive amount of diversity in play, including seamless transitions between acrobatic-inspired running, combat, vehicles, and boss fights, including but not limited to the return of the infamous T-Rex, which I know was super exciting when fans saw that key art, which has Lara running away from the T-Rex.
Looks so good.
It's a shot of nostalgia. So, Robin, have you had a chance to play the game?
I did. I played it on your phone, by the way.
Yes.
Everyone, you have to go play this. It is a must-play. It's a lot of fun.
Well, right now, currently, the reason Rob is playing it on my phone is because it is only out in the Netherlands. We soft launched it there to test it and work out all the kinks before full launch. So soon we will have news on when it is coming for a global release. When it releases globally, it will be launching on iOS, Android, and Win 8 phones. And we are very excited to get you more details on that. So I'll make sure to give you guys an update as soon as it's live.
In next news, we have a bit of franchise excitement to spread around. The 2013 Tomb Raider reboot crossed a major milestone this month, selling more than 8.5 million copies worldwide. In addition to hitting first-day and month sales records, this achievement makes it the best-selling title in franchise history. We released a handful of early concepts from the Tomb Raider reimagining on the blog to celebrate. They look really good. If you haven't seen them yet, check them out at tombraider.tumblr.com.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing to do, is to find reasons to release concept art from past games, because we have so much and a lot of stuff that you guys have never seen before. So I find any reason to celebrate.
And they look beautiful. You guys, look at them.
They're quite cool. In another bit of mobile news, Lara Croft's original adventure, as in 1996 original adventure, launched on Android devices this month. An iOS update also became available. So you can look for both of them on the App Store and the Google Play Store, supported in English, German, Spanish, French, Hungarian, Italian, Dutch, Portuguese, and Brazilian Portuguese, which is a lot of languages.
That's a ton.
Yeah, I've always said, as a nerdy tidbit about myself, that if I could choose any superpower, it would be to speak every language living or dead on the world, which I think would be much more interesting than flying.
Also coding languages, right?
Yes, because they all count in my head, because I make the rules.
In other news, in addition to our other two recent hires in studio, which we talked about in the last podcast, we welcomed industry vet Casey Lynch to the studio this month, and he is taking up post as editorial director for Square Enix. As editorial director, Casey provides editorial guidance to the suite of Square Enix franchises throughout their development, delivering internal feedback and recommendations. And he draws on experience as EIC at IGN, as well as his PR and biz dev experience. Welcome, Casey.
Welcome, Casey. He's a great guy and a great asset to both the studio and Square Enix as a whole, so it's great to have him on board.
Also has awesome hair.
Yes, he does, actually, and an awesome goatee. I'm not a facial hair expert. That's a goatee, right? I hope he listens to this and gets embarrassed.
Some sort of facial hair.
But it's pretty epic. It's kind of Viking-inspired.
Check out his Twitter.
All right, on to our newsletter. A monthly newsletter has returned, which recaps the big news of the month and showcases fan art, studio snapshots, and more. If you can't keep up with daily updates and would like to have a big monthly recap sent straight to your inbox, you can sign up at crystald.com. And what's up next, Robin?
In other news, Bill Durant of Punished Props is making an awesome replica bow of, well, replica of Lara's bow, I should say.
Yes.
It's not just any bow, it's Lara's bow. And it's from Rise of the Tomb Raider. Follow his progress at facebook.com/punishprops for pictures and video.
Yeah, eventually he'll have a recap video of the entire build. Bill is a fantastic asset to both the cosplay community and the prop making community, and you can learn a lot from him. So if you're thinking of maybe making your own replicas someday, you should definitely check him out. And last up, a reminder that our official forums have a lot of fun and exclusive content on them, including a LC2 community challenge thread where people are diligently keeping track of challenge progress and rewards, as well as exclusive forum Q&As, contests, and more. So check them out, the official Tomb Raider forums. Okay, so we are going to transition to our Systems of Survival segment with Brian Horton shortly, and then Robin will return for her classic crystal feature. So thank you, Robin.
Thank you. We're going to talk about Easter eggs.
Easter eggs.
So it's getting real.
Hold on to your pants. Is that a saying? I have Brian Horton here with me, our game director on Rise of the Tomb Raider, and we're going to talk about the systems of survival, which is really exciting because we touched on this briefly with Game Informer, but we're going to dive a little bit deeper into it.
Yeah, it's really exciting. We had a little bit of a tease on what that all means, but I'd love to go into more detail
Great.
In this segment.
Awesome. So, in the 2013 Tomb Raider reboot, survival was a bit more of a narrative theme more than a systemic feature. So can you talk about how survival evolved from the reboot into Rise of a Tomb Raider?
Sure. We always wanted to do, as much as we could, bring survival into the gameplay of Tomb Raider. And especially the last one, we were experimenting with a lot of different things, like gathering like health management, injuries, and things of that ilk that you can often think of are part of survival. But what we found was the loop was slower than we wanted it to be, and it's something you'd have to maintain, and it took away from the overall pacing of the game. So those concerns still exist for us, but we did want to go deeper and take survival systems further. The way we decided to do that is to put a resource behind the hunt itself. So it's not just a generic XP, but it actually has physical things, like you're getting hide off of deer or other animals that you hunt in the game. And those go into crafting recipes. These recipes are used for arrow upgrades. They're used for different weapons and things in the game that you can enhance. So not only can I craft a resource to make a new arrowhead type, like a poison arrow, but I can also strengthen my bow with that. So the ability to then tie hunting more into a loop that actually helps your character get better felt like that was the right blend of bringing that survivalist system into our game without slowing down our pacing. In Tomb Raider, we have three core pillars which existed in the last Tomb Raider game. We have traversal, we have puzzle solving or smart resourceful Lara, as we call it, and we have the combat. Now, the combat's changed slightly. The smart resourceful Lara, the puzzles have changed slightly, and traversal is pretty much built on the same foundation that we had in the last game. So let me talk a little bit about the differences. Mm-hmm. So for Smart Resourceful Lara, we really wanted to try to create challenges that are a little bit larger. So our tombs are no longer one isolated location with one isolated problem, but they're spread across this large, vast place. The player's gonna have to solve smaller puzzles that all work against a large goal, and that is our nested puzzle formula. So that's one of our big important loops that we have in the game. The other one is our combat, and we've created this guerrilla combat style now, which is new for the franchise, that really incorporates pre-combat as much as it does assault combat. So the player has a little bit more flexibility in how they are going to approach enemies or approach animals, and that loop works the same way. The more cautious you are approaching an animal or an enemy, the more you can take them unaware, and that gives you an advantage. Mm-hmm. So we really want to try to use traversal as a means to find places of advantage, and that could be something, you know, Lara is climbing up to a tree and getting into a high ground, or she could be going low ground and using bushes and low cover. So that is a big difference from the last game of how we're evolving the systems and the gameplay loops to create a more rewarding experience And we think it wraps really well into the overall survival sandbox that we've created with the new location in Siberia.
So can you expand a little bit more into some of the unique resources that you'll be able to gather in Rise of the Tomb Raider, which I think fans are really going to enjoy? So we have animals, we have plants, and other things. So you want to dive into that?
We tried to come up with recipes that felt practical to the environment. So in survival research that we've done, you know, it's really looking at what you have available to you. And in this Siberian location, we knew we were going to have some plant life. We knew we were going to have things like scraps of cloth. And we knew we were going to have animals. And those were foundations for a lot of the recipes that we could use to craft. The other thing that we're, you know, making use of is the salvage system that you saw before was very generic. But we really want to make sure that everything you acquire had a practical application to something that you would use. So if I had a piece of hide and I had some cloth, that seemed like a really good combination to upgrade your bow. So we really wanted to make sure we've contextualized everything that we acquire to come up with a recipe that would make sense to something that you would see visibly on your character. So that idea of the things I collect create a world fiction connection that will feel satisfying to the player once they've found these things. They go, oh yeah, that makes sense. If I took these berries from this tree and I took this cloth, I could use it to bind one of my wounds. And having that ability to now in-game make a choice to speed up your recovery through healing items seemed like another great way that we could expand into that collection and resource system.
Very cool. And so when it comes to these resources, can you choose what you want to use them for? They have multiple uses, they have single uses, or?
Multiple uses. So the cloth that I acquired and the berries that I acquired, those make a great recipe for healing items. But I could also use that cloth and a hide and some sticks or some other things to create another upgrade. So it's really player choice. You gather these resources that gives you an ability to make your strategic choice of going, I want to be more defensive or offensive. And we think that gives the player that feeling of like, oh, when I played the game, I use these resources this way, and their friend could use them a completely different way.
Okay. And can you touch on the rarity or scarcity of some of these? So are some of these upgrades pretty difficult to get because the items, the recipes are more complex?
Yeah, so we discussed a little bit, some animals only come out at certain times of day. So I might need to find this specific buck, and he only comes out at night. And you hunt that, you know, when you hunt that buck, you get the horns and you get the antlers, and those antlers will be a very scarce resource, something that you feel, you know, once you've acquired it, you can do something really cool and get a significant upgrade. So yes, we are trying to create some resources that you have to look for, and you can find out information about that through journals and other things that you find in the world that can give you ideas of like what I should be looking for.
So spinning off from that then, let's get a bit more into hunting and how hunting has evolved, because that obviously feels quite natural to Lara having to survive in the wild. So there has been quite a step up from hunting in the last game.
Yeah, we don't force the player to hunt.
Yes.
For those out there that didn't feel great about killing the deer.
Yes. But
we do encourage it as a means to upgrade your character. So the recipes and the resources we get from animals will all lead to recipes that allow you to upgrade Lara. So the different animals that we've introduced, even the bear, which is an enemy that's extremely tough at the beginning, will have resources that have a big payoff. So the hope is to try to create recipes that will utilize the different animals that we have based on the region that you're in. And then when you introduce a new animal, we get new crafting and upgrade abilities. So the hope would be that the player is going to spend some time and invest in that, and they can immediately find a use for it, and they'll immediately find an upgrade when they go back to the base camp and be able to utilize these things to create a much more robust and rich character.
So what about the animal AI? Has that improved, or Lara's ability to track and find these animals?
We've tried to create a AI for animals that is believable. So you're not going to be able to walk right up to a deer. They're very much aware If the player is moving quickly, they're going to hear the sound of your footsteps, and they're going to skitter away. So you, as a player, controlling your speed, utilizing cover, staying up and away from an animal to be able to get close is something that we've ensured that the AI feels believable in that way. We also have them using a need system. So if they're hungry or thirsty, they will go to a feeding bush or to water. So we really want to make sure that the animal feels like as they're just living in the world, and even if you were just to observe, that they go through patterns that are not just scripted, that they have needs that they will fulfill. And that creates a more naturalistic sense of herding and gathering a location. If sounds go off, you'll see them perk their ears up and start to look around. So we try to make sure the world has an ecosystem in and of itself, and the animal AI respects that.
And another pretty cool thing is that you can see their footprints in the snow, too. So in those environments, you'll be able to see and track them from afar, correct?
The environment interactivity that we've put into the game not only just goes to Lara and the enemies, but it goes to the animals as well. So what's really cool, you come into one of our valleys, the snow-filled valleys, and you can see a deer, and then all of a sudden you see it start to make tracks, and you might lose it around a corner, but those tracks remain. So you can use those tracks as a way to locate and track down the animal that you want to hunt. Or it's just great to see that feedback. If you're, like I said, if you're not into the animal hunting aspect, that you can appreciate the connection between the player characters, animals, and the world that they live in.
All right, so specifically with base camps, we've talked a little bit about crafting and so on, but there are new features and new things that you can do at base camp.
We don't want to have much restriction. The things that we're trying to do is make sure that we're pacing these upgrades along the path. So using base camps as a means to open up the ability to buy to craft new resources, like basically find your recipes. Sometimes we do that narratively, sometimes we do that at base camp and something you can purchase. So there's many more things that we can purchase in the game now. And we're going to go into a lot of detail of that in the future, but know that we're really trying to expand these systems and give the player a lot more choice on how they choose to play the game. And that ultimately is the thing that we find most exciting. The other thing that's really exciting is besides base camps, which were, you know, plentiful enough, but also few and far between, if there are situations where you're in the field and you want to craft items, we now have crafting on the fly. So that was a big change from what we were at on the base camps, mm-hmm. where that was the only place we can craft. Now, if I have a recipe and I've earned that recipe, which I've bought at a base camp, now I can craft that poison arrow tip, for instance, on the fly. Once I found my resources, my mushrooms and my cloth, now I've got poison arrows on the fly.
So generally speaking, when people talk about survival in the wilderness or so on, they're thinking about hunger meters and that sort of thing, having to find those immediate resources like food or water and so on. But we're not going to encumber the players with those sorts of mechanics, correct?
It's something that we really wish worked better with the survival action formula, but it doesn't. So when we did experiment with the idea of hunger as something that we'd have to maintain by, you know, hunting for food or going to water and streams to drink, these all seem like very natural things to do in a survival situation. But once again, we really try to put those through the filter of the pace of the story and the game we're trying to make, and it really didn't weave very well into that pacing. So the best thing I could say is we did attempt these things. They do make a lot of sense in context of survival, but not so much for the game that we're trying to make. We are encouraged, though, by the fact that we have opened up many more resources that you can collect, things that you can acquire through hunting, and making our hub spaces as rich and dense as we possibly can. So if you are going off the beaten path and you are exploring, you're going to find so many things that are going to reward the player for that exploration. And to be able to turn that around and make a choice on how you want to play the game, we think that ultimately makes it feel, it gives you that feeling of improvisational survival. Mm-hmm. Like things, the choices you make a difference on between life and death.
That sounds like a good balance. Okay, Brian, we're going to take a quick break, but then you're going to be back to answer some fan questions. So stick around. Okay, Brian, are you ready for some fan questions?
Let's do it.
They're always great. And they always have the great names, like this one, Chocolate Shake asks, I love this question, are ancient traps like darts and spikes making a comeback in Tomb Areas?
We are invested in traps. I'm not going to go into detail of the types of traps because I want you guys to be surprised when you encounter them in the game. But Noah was extremely specific about wanting to see traps come back to Tomb Raider, and being a part of the puzzle team, we've been able to bring those to our levels, and it's very exciting.
That's all we need to say, I feel like, because just the confirmation that there are some of these more contrived ancient traps, I think, is pretty great.
Yeah, you know, tombs are guarded, and we've talked a lot about animal guardians, but, you know, traps are a big part of the recipe for tombs.
Protecting their secrets, great. All right, he has, oh, it was another question from him, from Chocolate Shake. Will there be a level hub set in an urban space? And he says this applies both to Rise and future titles, which we are not talking about future titles. We are only talking about Rise at this time. But we have showcased in a screenshot that there is some sort of semi-urban facility. You can talk about that lightly.
So we're in the Game Informer footage, we showed a vista, and we have a screenshot of it, and a lot of people have tried to interpret what that is, and this is a Soviet mining camp. So you see train tracks, and you see resources, and they are mining for resources, and if you Google that, you can find these Soviet installations, and we reference them heavily, and it's a cool destroyed urban environment. It's not a currently occupied one, so.
It appeals to that sort of layers of history, though, correct? Because there is the, there's a lot of history there even before the Russian installations. So.
Absolutely, and like I said, the other thing that's important in our layers of history formula is not all of them are active, you know? So, you know, we like the idea of something that's almost modern, but not quite, mm-hmm. you know, middle history, having its own sense of ruin.
How much real-world research, actual history, geography, goes into designing, writing, and writing the story of a game? And is it a challenge to keep it entertaining? I thought that this would be a great question for you because you get to do a lot of that early research, not just from a visual perspective, but that historical perspective, correct?
Yeah, we pride ourselves on doing research. Tomb Raider is a mix of, as Noah would say, Googleable myths, something that you can look up and understand. But we always like to take a twist, in getting John Stafford and Rihanna to help build that fiction and make it our own and build upon something that you know is always important. And from a research perspective, Bren, as art director and myself, we really love to dive in and do a lot of research, whether it's online. Or going to locations. So I haven't announced locations that we researched on this last game, but we always tend to find some place that we can photograph, and we bring that photography back, and it helps the team, inspires the team on not only the way things look, but the way the culture feels. Mm-hmm. So I love capturing the broad, vast reference as well as the details that help make a culture and a place feel legitimate.
And so do you take those creative licenses? Because he asks, is it a challenge to keep it entertaining? So how strictly do you hold yourself to those real-world constraints versus your own sort of creative imagination and the team's imagination?
We like to think of it as the foundation. It's the bedrock by which we build our mm-hmm. fiction, right? If you don't have something that's believable as a foundation, anything that you put in there that has a fantastic twist or something that we were inventing tends to fall short of believable. So, you know, I stay away from the word realism because I don't think our game is necessarily about realism, but it's about a believable universe and something that you feels familiar, but then mm-hmm. when you bring in that something that's different, something that is unique and invented, that you can swallow it as something that is real.
So here we had a pair of questions about stealth. Will Rise of the Tomb Raider contain a developed stealth system or stealth kills? And will the route you choose, stealthy or head-on, affect the turnout of the game? So that was from Chris02 and GetB97.
So we do have pre-combat, which is our form of stealth, and that allows the player to pick a path that will allow her to be unseen and take advantage of the fact that the enemy AI is unaware of Lara. We've expanded on, we had a little bit of that in the last Tomb Raider game, but we've really expanded on those systems. And that being able to have more navigation choice on where to go, whether I take a high ground, whether I'm going up trees or going along bushes or even using the water as a means to escape being seen, really brings a lot of interesting dynamics to the combat loop. So we're very excited about this new rich experience of being unaware to the AI. And then if you choose, you could play that same scenario full combat. And for the different players, they're going to have a different experience. And we support both in all of our combat setups.
And there's pros and cons to each, correct? Because you're going to use a lot more resources if you go head on into combat.
Exactly. And there are some situations, to be clear, that we are going to force an assault. Mm-hmm. But we try to make sure that we balance that mostly with situations that the player has some choice. You can completely sneak past a full squadron of enemies in certain situations, and that brings its own satisfaction in and of itself, creating distractions, using the different kinds of cover that the player can, that Lara can use, whether it be high ground or low ground, and that has its own sense of reward. So expect to see a lot more player choice when it comes to combat in this game.
That's great for replayability too. Great. Okay, well, thank you very much, Brian. We'll have you back next month for another Take 5 segment.
Great. It's great talking to the fans, and looking forward to giving you guys some more information when we can give it
yes,
to you.
We can say it's going to be at E3. We can say that E3 you will not miss Rise of the Tomb Raider, so that'll be great.
All right.
Look forward to that. And now for Crystal Compass Radio prior to our classic feature. This episode we'll be listening to the masterfully crafted Venice Violins by Nathan McCree and the haunting main theme to Angel of Darkness by Peter Conley. Have a request for what track you'd like to hear next month? Send your thoughts to community@crystald.com. Enjoy!
Welcome back, everyone, and thanks for joining me for the Classic Crystal segment of the podcast. Our topic this month is the Easter eggs of the Tomb Raider franchise. Here, we'll be counting down favorite Easter eggs from the franchise ranging from the classic titles to more recent adventures such as Temple of Osiris and the 2013 reboot. We'll also be joined by Brian Horton, who will tell us about his favorite Easter egg. To begin our countdown, we'll start with number 8 on our list, which finds us in the main hall of Croft Manor in Tomb Raider 1. As you begin the game, you can walk through the gym and are introduced to the main hall. You'll see a group of crates that the delivery people have yet to move. Next to those crates, you'll find the Golden Ark of the Covenant. Easter egg number 7 on the list is when Lara visits the streets of Paraiso, Peru. After Lara punches the ball past the dummy and into the gap between the two narrow fences resembling a soccer, or should we say football, goal, you can hear the crowd erupt in cheers, yelling. Speaking of football, let's move on to a more recent Easter egg in our December 2014 release, Lara Croft and the Temple of Osiris. First noted in the forum Temple of Osiris discussion thread, if you venture up to the northernmost point near the Tomb of the Silversmith, you'll find an oval-shaped arena with a regenerating ball at the center and two giant circular basins at opposite ends. Sound like something familiar? If it sounded like a football pitch to you, then you would be correct. When creating the game, the LC2 team purposely added a mini soccer game to the arena, hoping players would find it and get a little extra competition element when they're playing the game. There's even a convenient health generation station directly above the field for injured players to quickly recover and get back onto the pitch to keep playing. Easter egg number 5 is the creatures of the Tomb Raider franchise receiving fan names. In Tomb Raider Underworld, we met Underpuss, the Kraken, who later appeared in Tomb Raider 2013 as a stuffed plush animal in Lara's endurance cabin. The third Easter egg on our list is from Tomb Raider 2013, where we had Fifi the Crab. Fifi the Crab had an unlockable secret achievement if you happened to hunt Fifi. It was called Crab Cakes. Fun fact, Fifi was the name attributed to the crab after fans saw it in the Tomb Raider reboot Turning Point trailer at E3 2011. Our third Easter egg on this list is a group of Easter eggs focusing on another classic Crystal franchise, Legacy of Kain. In Tomb Raider Legend and Anniversary, you can find several references to this franchise, such as Kain's portrait, Raziel's clan symbol emblazoned on Lara's jacket and wetsuit, or Lara's ability to wield the Soul Reaver in Tomb Raider Legend. penultimate Easter egg on our list is the classic chime from Tomb Raider 2013, which is a direct reference to all the earlier classic Tomb Raider games. This is also my personal favorite of all the Easter eggs we might have mentioned. So spoiler alert for those who haven't played Tomb Raider 2013, spoiler alert. After unlocking the last GPS cache in Tomb Raider 2013, the chime from Tomb Raider 1 will ring, and Lara will say her infamous,
aha,
much like she does in the past games, tributing herself to all the previous games where she explored tombs and began all those crazy adventures that we know and love. And here I have with me is Brian Horton, our game director for Rise of the Tomb Raider. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
And he's here to talk to us about his favorite Easter egg.
Yeah, I love Easter eggs. Ever since I've been playing games, I always found that the reward for going off path and finding something and feeling, oh my God, I just found something that, you know, and it allows you to be a little irreverent. You don't have to, it's not too serious. And one of my favorite Easter eggs on Tomb Raider 2013 was actually cut from the final game, but it was a familiar volleyball with a red handprint and straw coming out for hair. And the fact that we had it at the E3 trailer, E3 playthrough on the stage demo, and someone spotted it and commented on it made me, pretty happy. But yeah, it didn't end up making the final cut. But we're always inspired by different games, different movies, different media. And obviously we were making a survival story. And that Tom Hanks movie, Castaway, was definitely one of our inspirations, and it was just, we thought it was a funny thing to have in the den with a crazy dude with dreadlocks.
It was a magical moment too, seeing that there, like, and having everyone spot it too.
Yeah, and that's the cool thing about Easter eggs is it's sort of like a little inside joke for people if they spent the time, like, oh, did you find that thing, that crazy thing that no one else really saw. Another Easter egg that I don't know if people know about, but I always get a chuckle from, is we had this little plush bunny collectible around a really sad story about this family in 2013 that perished on the island. But just for a laugh, and we never meant it to be anything other than a laugh, we put our biggest, burliest scavenger on the Endurance boat, had that little bunny tucked into his belt. And a lot of people saw it, and they thought, oh my God, is he the guy that killed the family? And like, we never thought of it that way, but you know, Cam, you and I thought it would be funny just to tuck it into his belt, this big, huge, burly dude that you have to beat up to get through the Endurance mission.
I don't think I ever saw that bunny
on him. He's got a bunny on his belt, so now if you play it again, you can look for it.
Maybe it's just his weakness. He's like a big softie.
He is a big softie.
Yeah, that's good. All right, thanks, Brian.
Thank you very much.
Okay, everyone, that's it for this edition of the Classic Crystal segment. Thank you for listening and tuning in and talking rabbits, volleyballs, and Classic Tomb Raider with me, all under the premise that these are Easter eggs. Special shout-outs to our forum contributors, Ray, Rolly, Alex Weiss, Dark Seven Angel, Max, Raider, Error96, Driver, NSW Pride, and Ellis Ray. We appreciate your Easter eggs that you sent us. We picked them, and thanks for contributing. We hope to see you again on the forums soon. Until next time, Robin out.
And that's it for this episode. Remember, you can send all your feedback and show suggestions to community@crystald.com. Until next time.